Hello, and welcome to The Peace Frequency, a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, activists, and learners from across the globe to discuss and debate the important work of building peace in our time. The Peace Frequency is brought to you by the United States Institute of Peace Global Campus, preparing individuals around the world through online learning to prevent and transform violent conflict. You can learn more about the Global Campus at usipglobalcampus.org. I am your host, Darren Cambridge. And this past Monday, the Global Campus launched the four-week online course, Negotiation, Shaping the Conflict Landscape. And so today's show is actually the first in a series of four that will focus on negotiation, the skills, dynamics, and experiences of those who practice, teach, and train as negotiators. We have a wonderful lineup of guests this month, and we are joined today in the studio by Dr. Anthony Wanese St. John. Anthony is director of the International Peace and Conflict Resolution Master's Program at American University here in Washington, D.C. I am an AU alum myself, so much props to that. He researches all kinds of international negotiations, military, humanitarian, ceasefires, and peace processes. He has created and taught several advanced courses on negotiation, ranging from interpersonal skills and analysis to complex multilateral challenges. He also conducts advanced negotiation, mediation, and conflict resolution trainings for the U.S. military and civilian agencies, international organizations, humanitarian NGOs, as well as business organizations from all over the world. He is also an advisor to the Academy of International Conflict Management and Peacebuilding here at USIP. And lastly, we are privileged to have Anthony as the main instructor in this online negotiation course. So he is my guest today, but will actually be co-hosting this show and this podcast with me throughout the month of February during the run of his course. So Anthony, it's wonderful to have you on the show, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here.
We are also joined in the studio, as always, by our on-air producer, Vanessa Francis, who will be moderating your questions and comments during the show. So, Vanessa, it's good to have you in the studio and on the mic. Can you say hello?
Thanks, Darren. And everyone online, I'm looking forward to getting your thoughts and questions over to Anthony today.
Great. Vanessa's fresh back from Ireland, so I hope the jet lag isn't too bad. We look to listeners like you to help guide this conversation and really engage with our guests. So when you have a question or a comment, all you need to do is notify Vanessa by clicking that little raise hand button on your control panel, and Vanessa will get you queued up. She will then let you know when you are about to go on air. She will unmute you and bring you into the show so you can share your question or comment directly. Now, if you do not have a microphone on your computer, you can also instant message Vanessa by typing your question or your comment into the chat box, which you'll see on your control panel, and then Vanessa will read it for you on air. And to those listeners out there who are also participants in the online course, this is a great opportunity for you to get to know the man in the videos, a little bit more about him. And so please take advantage of this opportunity to get to know Anthony. So with that, let's jump right in. Anthony, you have dedicated much of your professional career to studying and teaching the art of negotiation. And you've put a great deal of energy in being the author and the architect of this online negotiation course that we're offering this month. Why do you think negotiation is not only an important skill set for people to have, but one that can and should be taught?
Well, I feel very firmly, and one of the assumptions that went into this course, that negotiation is a skill that we can learn, that we're not necessarily sort of born good at it. I feel very much that I was not really good at it for an important part of my life, and that negotiation for me was something that would make my palms sweat. Like when I look at a rock wall and you're trying to go rock climbing, you just feel the danger. I can feel it now as I mention it. There's a sort of dare and a sort of latent danger in it. So negotiation for me was a scary thing growing up, and I wasn't sure how I could ask for the things I wanted or needed from people who I wasn't sure would be willing to let me have them. And I had the mistaken idea that people are either born masters at this or you're just never going to be good at it. Along the way, I guess in my life, I learned that, in fact, there are people who can increase their skill. All of us can increase our knowledge and our skill. And in fact, I began to increase my knowledge and skill in negotiation. So I became very hopeful for myself, but also for the people I care about and the people I train and teach, that this is something that they can personally do and benefit from.
You know, this reminds me of a conversation that we had in the course we offered just this past month in January, Community-Based Peacebuilding, Engaging Youth. The first session in that course talked about the distinction between dialogue and debate. And it was mentioned that the collective we, I would say specifically in Western cultures and in my experience growing up in America, that we are taught how to debate and argue and right. win an argument. But this concept, this idea, this skill set of dialogue, not so much. Do you think negotiation has a similar story as you compare it to something like debate, a way to communicate? Do you think it just kind of is assumed that people know how to engage in that way, but in fact they don't?
Yeah, I think you're making an important point here that some of the ways that we are trained to interact with others are usually not very good for either getting what we want or for the relationships in which those conversations are happening. So instead of really good negotiation skills, we teach people how to fight, how to argue, how to diminish the credibility of their counterparts, sort of the way we approach our legal problems in the legal system is to discredit the arguments or even the character of the other party. And I think that the way I approach negotiation and the way many people approach it is very different from that sort of classical fight stance that you have to win and they have to lose. Over the years, there have evolved new ways of conceptualizing what negotiation is that are less about arguing and more about listening to begin with, less about talking and more about trying to perceive what's happening in the environment around you. So there is a very parallel, I think, development to the dialogue one.
Now, as you welcome folks into the online course, you said that negotiation has been, quote, a personally empowering skill for you. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that for me personally, it's been a triumph to learn about something that helps me be a more effective person in the world. You know, I feel like, there's the Oliver Twist story by Charles Dickens that a lot of people in my generation had to read in school. You might have seen the film version. There's a moment where the boy, who's essentially a child slave, approaches the food line and says, "Please, sir, I want some more," right? And he takes that dare to say, "Can I have a little more sustenance?" And they all go crazy, right? Because he has dared to ask for what he's really entitled to. And not even all that he's entitled to, just a little bit. And there are negative consequences for him for daring to ask. I think that's an assumption that some people go into the world, into life with, that if you try to get what you need and try to persuade people, they will say no, or the deck will be stacked against you. And so people sort of give up before they even try. And that leads to frustration and all sorts of negative consequences. The opposite is enabling yourself to envision that there is a conversation that's possible. There are many ways to conduct that conversation and many possible outcomes that might be better than staying silent and staying passive. That's what I mean when I say it's empowering. It enables us to do something on behalf of ourselves and those who we negotiate for. It allows you to be effective in making a difference and getting results, whatever your profession is.
Now, you mentioned the scene from Oliver Twist, and actually I think there's a cartoon version of that, which I grew up watching. It's one of my favorite movies. But I remember the scene with the bowl. And, you know, people probably have a lot of different images or things that come to mind when they hear the word negotiation from movies or from their own personal life, salary negotiation or heads of state negotiating over ceasefires or peace processes or whatever.
Right.
So let's back up a little bit, actually. What is your definition of negotiation and what images or examples beyond Oliver Twist does this definition conjure up for you?
You know, at its simplest for me, negotiation is any time we're trying to persuade others. That's the very simplest definition I can give. And that means all kinds of strategic interactions with people, whether it is the way we drive our car down the highway or the way we interact with people in our organizations, the way we work within our families and relate to people. There's that sort of implicit negotiation that happens throughout life. But then there's also the transactional negotiations where there's a specific subject and decisions that have to be made about it because there's some contention or differences. So on the formal side of defining negotiation, I go back to some of my mentors like Jeffrey Rubin at Tufts, Bill Zartman here at Hopkins, and Tom Schelling before both of them. And they talk about things like shared decision making. Whereas, you know, unilateral decision making, executive decision making is just one decision maker figuring out what they need to do. Shared decision making, we need others to buy in to the thing we're trying to decide. We can't decide it alone. So that shared decision making really is at the heart of a more formal understanding of negotiation. Into that, though, we have to add additional elements like some uncertainty. We don't know about the capabilities, the good faith intentions, or the real underlying interests of the other parties. They don't know those about us. So there's some uncertainty. There's also potential conflict. We may have a bad history with each other. We may have heard bad things about each other. We may not know each other, or we may know each other too well. And so there is a past history, potential conflict that casts a shadow on today's negotiation. And then finally, I'd say we have to add into this a third element that's about the asymmetry of the parties. Me going to a government agency and trying to get a transaction done, me individually against that agency, you know, there's a power differential. Me going up against a big multinational corporation to try to, you know, get some rights satisfied or something, there's a power differential. Mm-hmm. So negotiations don't necessarily happen in situations of perfect balance of power. And those impact how we think and how we define negotiation. So shared decision-making, but asymmetry, potential conflict or real conflict, and some uncertainties. Lots of examples got me thinking about these ways of defining and conceiving negotiation. I moved around a lot as a child. We were a military family. My father was also in the airline. So we were hopping around a lot every few years. I was always the new kid. The new kid sometimes has a hard time being accepted initially and may or may not even know how to get accepted. I have to say that there was a lot of schoolyard sort of violence that came my way. And I didn't know how to talk my way out of it. I would try a lot of things. I'd say, you know, like I can remember one day on the first day of school in a new place, somebody came up and said, "I call you out," which meant we're going to fight after school. they informed me. So I went up to him and I said, "You know, I would actually like to get to know you and be your friend. I don't have any friends in this neighborhood."
Where in the world is this?
This is in Queens. Mm-hmm. I moved a lot between Queens and Brooklyn. And so he responded, of course, that no, we had to have the fight. And I insisted. I said, "Hey, your name is Anthony. My name's Anthony. We could be friends. You know, we're in eighth grade. I don't know anybody here." But he was insistent. So I had to go down and fight him. And this kind of thing happened over and over and over again. And it makes you think the world is made of people who either want to fight you or don't care. And it made me hunger for, you know, another perspective. Is life all about struggling against adversaries, or is it about building cooperative relations with people? And my early experiences, you know, were not very, didn't give me a lot of hope on the latter. But I held on to the little hope that there was and thought there must be ways to talk these things through. I can't be fighting my way through every situation. Along the way, I found allies. Along the way, I found friends. Along the way, I learned to distinguish between, you know, people who have your best interests at heart and people who don't. And I began to learn what's persuasive to people and how to even out the playing field occasionally. So learning to talk your way out of things was an important sort of survival skill for me as a kid. And it led to my, you know, deep affinity for communications issues, especially in situations of personal or group conflict. So that's a little bit about the genesis of my interest. You know, at the same time, the rest of the world was sort of going to hell. In the 60s and 70s, there was tons of violent conflict around the world, and that was the background noise to my growing up. We had remnants of the Vietnam War winding down as I grew up.
And you're thinking about all these things as a 12-year-old, as a 13-year-old, or?
Thinking might be a strong word, but
awareness,
but hearing about it constantly, hearing about Indochina, hearing about returning veterans, hearing about social conflicts in the United States over civil rights, over those who advocated for peace versus those who advocated for our foreign policies that were more interventionist. So those are joined by the wars in the Middle East in the early 70s and late 60s, and other trouble spots around the world. I wasn't terribly knowledgeable or interested, but they formed a constant backdrop to my thinking. And at some point, I think I began to make parallels between the interpersonal and the international conflict settings, and thinking about, you know, is it only force that resolves these things, or are there other ways?
I'm starting to get a better understanding of how you ended up in the position you're in now, running a master's program on international peace and conflict resolution.
Right.
It was back when you were 12 years old and recognizing some of these things. So can you tell us a little bit more about that process and that journey that began around that moment in your life, trying to get out of fights and be persuasive? Like you said earlier, you weren't necessarily consciously thinking about these things. That may be a strong word, but there was an awareness about things that were happening in your personal life, connections to it in the international realm. How did you begin this process to start learning about communication styles, being persuasive, what it means to be persuasive? Where did you go? Who did you look to? You mentioned some names earlier. What did you read to begin this process?
I think there's no single strand here, but a couple of things that I thought about with regard to this question were, one, a deep question about, are we doing the best we can as humanity? Wars never seemed like a good thing, right? Even if they might be justified, I would ask myself, even as a child, is this the best we could do? Is this the only way we know how to resolve our problems? Just as it was in the schoolyard, I thought we could do better than this. Certainly, I thought at the national political and international political levels, this can't be all. It seems so savage to think about, you know, mutually assured destruction as the only way to manage superpower tensions. Today, I understand the logic of deterrence, right? And I wouldn't hesitate to say that that might have been the right thing at that time. But again, is that the best we could do? There was a lingering question for me. A second strand for me of thinking about, you know, what got me to thinking about negotiation and conflict resolution today was a certain desire to not be stuck in the way everybody else thinks, to be a little bit nonconformist. You know, in the 70s, there was that interesting and important book about individualism, Jonathan Livingston Seagull. I read it, and for me, it wasn't about selfishness or narcissism. It was kind of like a modern day parallel to the Emperor Has No Clothes sort of fable. Not everybody is going to speak truth to power when power is doing foolish things. And it's only the sort of crazy nonconformist who might take the chance. And I remember having a very serious debate with my youth group one night. It was a church youth group, too, over nuclear weapons. And I took a stance to just try out my ideas about saying, you know, these are not a good way for us to manage our relationship with the rest of the world.
And how old are you at this point?
14 or so.
Okay.
And I think they were going to kill me that night. There was such screaming and yelling and people rushing up to my face. Maybe I wasn't pacific about my arguments either, but this was a youth group, a church-run youth group, and there was going to be violence that night over the question of nonviolence versus, you know, deterrence. Mm. it made me a little afraid to see so much acceptance and conformity in people's ideas. They took what was fed to them, and they said, this is what we got. We can't think of anything different. So even though, you know, the problem wasn't that we disagreed. The problem for me was they couldn't think out of the box at all. So thinking out of the box on things seemed to be important. In later years after that, social justice issues came to the fore for me. The apartheid, the anti-apartheid movement was making its way around university campuses. I was part of that. There were civil wars in Nicaragua, El Salvador, and Guatemala. A number of the students that I interacted with and the professors at my school were all raising questions about whose side the United States should be on in some of those struggles. Were we supporting the right people? Were we arming people who were not necessarily good folks? Were we sending weapons to people who had, you know, terrible human rights records? Was there a negotiated solution to these problems is a question that I began to ask myself. The social justice question again brought me back to negotiation. There were really important attempts to negotiate those civil wars in Central America. And for a long time, people undermined those attempts, including by killing the negotiators. You might recall there was a community of Jesuits at an important university in San Salvador. One battalion of Salvadoran military came and killed them all in the night, as well as their housekeeper and her daughter. They had been quietly putting together the negotiations between the government and the guerrillas. So to kill the peacemakers, you know, it was a sobering moment about the dangers inherent in questioning the status quo. But it certainly didn't squash anybody's enthusiasm about the need to find better solutions to conflicts, especially violent conflicts that have a justice component. But I wasn't satisfied with the, you know, dichotomy of either join the government or join the rebels. There had to be other things to do. And we talk about all those things here at USIP. Now I know what those other things are. At that time, I was still asking questions.
We're talking with Dr. Anthony Juanis St. John. He is the main instructor in the online negotiation course that we're offering through the Global Campus during the month of February. So to our listeners out there, if you have any questions or comments about negotiation, your experiences or understandings or perspectives on negotiation, we encourage you to chime in. If you have any questions for Anthony, just let our on-air producer, Vanessa Francis, know, and we can bring you and your ideas into the show. Anthony, your story actually about meeting with your church group reminded me of a question I asked you many, many years ago, and I don't know if you remember this, but to give our listeners a little bit of context, I, as I mentioned in the beginning, am a alum of American University. I've taken Anthony's classes. Just the other day, actually, I was cleaning up in my basement and I found the certificate from the Peace and Development Institute, Peacebuilding and Development Institute, and your name next to Ron Fisher's is signed there at the wow. bottom. And that was back in 2008 or 2007 or 2008 or something.
You could sell that on eBay.
Yeah, exactly. But I was telling my partner that, you know, I was like, this is really cool that I've come across the certificate because I've been working with you now this many years later on a negotiation course. So anyway, the question was, I think this was in 2008, I emailed a bunch of professors that I'd had in peace and conflict resolution field. You were one of them. And I was going to start teaching a peace education course. And I asked everyone to send me the names of peacemakers, their writings or their speeches that they felt were integral to their understanding of peace building. And you, and I still remember this, shared a name that was very much unique from everybody else. I got a lot of names that I'd already heard about from other folks.
Right.
And you sent me the name Helder Câmara.
Dom Helder Câmara.
Dom Helder Câmara.
Brazilian Archbishop.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about Dom Helder Câmara? And are there connections between the stories that you just told about what was happening throughout Latin America and how you got introduced to Helder Câmara?
In those days, I was part of a Catholic peace group called Pax Christi. There were many times where I felt Pax Christi was too sort of mainstream for my youthful, you know, ideas. They were too accepting of the status quo. But it was sort of the cutting edge of the church's thinking on progressive international relations issues. Dom Helder Câmara and others were part of a movement in the Catholic Church called Liberation Theology that was very seriously fought by an important theologian named Cardinal Ratzinger, who later became the Pope. So the Catholic liberation theology movement emerged from poor countries, a lot in Latin America and in Asia, where both the faithful and the clergy started saying the church has been too long on the side of the landed elites who hold all the power, all the money, and typically all the guns. Liberation theology was saying, no, the message of religion should be really about earthly redemption and justice rather than waiting for heavenly redemption and justice. So it posed a direct challenge to some of the tendencies in the church. And I thought that I had a lot of affinity with the liberation theologians, at least some of them, and at least some of the time, not always, but I thought that there was some important questions to be raised. I wasn't always happy with their answers, but I was very happy with the questions and the questioning of the status quo. Romero, Archbishop Romero in El Salvador was one, just like Elder Camara. There were several others around the world whose names I probably have forgotten today. There were the Berrigan brothers here in the United mm-hmm. States who made their mark on the nuclear issue. They would get themselves arrested, you know, breaking into General Electric plants that were involved in the production of weapons. They raised a lot of questions about our foreign policies. Again, I wasn't always happy with their answers, but the questions were important. I could think of other answers sometimes, but they got conversations going that otherwise were not happening because people were sort of, you know, accepting and throw their hands up in the air. What could we do about these terrible social conflicts? Well, some people said we could do something about it. Mm-hmm. I was impressed that by the idea that we could do something about the problems our world faces.
Now, going back to negotiations specifically, you are a professor of international peace and conflict resolution, and you run that master's program at American University. And so that suggests that you have an ideological or normative commitment to peace. And I think the stories that you've shared from your childhood to present day, I think, demonstrates that. Does that make you an outlier or typical in the scholar-practitioner community with regard to negotiation?
I never thought about ideology when I got into conflict resolution and negotiation. I discovered that there was an ideological split among scholars today that I thought probably didn't exist 50 years ago. Yeah, there is a sort of stream of the peace studies scholar that is anti-war, anti-use of force, totally committed to nonviolence. And they split themselves off from those who today call themselves the security studies people. I think back in the Cold War, peace and security people were the same community, and they all were concerned with reducing the likelihood of catastrophic nuclear war. That split in the community is ideological. I don't know how real it is today. I certainly don't think that it's an important dichotomy. I think that we should always talk across these academic communities, certainly, and I don't see and I myself don't consider myself a pure pacifist. I can foresee situations in which I would totally be okay with the use of force to prevent a greater harm, to prevent an impending genocide, for example, or to interpose armed forces between those who need to stop fighting. So I don't see myself as ideological in that sense, although I do think there are important norms. Certainly, you know, avoiding war as much as possible should probably be one of them. Resolving it once it started and doing that right is probably another one. I in my teaching at AU, I look at peace processes around the world, and so many of them look like they've been handled well. And yet one of them that was handled in the classical way was the one in Rwanda that helped to end their civil war prior to the genocide. So I'm sort of sobered by the idea that we have a lot of good practices, and yet we can still have catastrophic outcomes. So we need to do some things better. That's where I'm not so much ideological as dedicated to finding better ways for us to, you know, make peace or prevent violence.
So we have a question or a comment from one of our listeners.
Wow.
Yes, we do. As you speak about peace processes around the world, we often find that we have to negotiate with people from different cultures. Do you have any tips or tricks in that regard?
Well, I'm from a different culture, so I guess tricks wouldn't be the right word, but I do come from a school of thought in the negotiation world that says that culture matters. 15 years ago, there was a very strong contingent of folks who said culture doesn't matter at all. We should all just negotiate the same way. They were very prescriptive. But over time, I think negotiation field has learned from sociologists and anthropologists and understood that people communicate differently from culture to culture. And negotiation for me is a very special kind of communication. Therefore, it must be impacted by cultural understandings. The problem is, where does one culture begin and where does one end? I'm from a different background than you, Vanessa, perhaps, but we know how to understand each other in probably 99% of the times that we interact, right? Cultural differences may not enter into our professional negotiations or engagements or work together. Where it does seem to matter is where people are highly unfamiliar with their counterparts' negotiation preferences, and where those cultural styles influence at least some of the preferences. So there are some folks who say, you know, our preferences for our tolerance for inequality in society is a culturally determined norm. So you'll have some societies around the world who are perfectly happy with a very uneven society where there are very powerful people and relatively disempowered people. And a lot of people will accept that because culture tells them that that's okay. And other societies that will be more relatively flat, people question the powerful, etc. Well, I think that those things influence how you would set up a negotiation, how much authority you would give your negotiator. In the highly hierarchical society, you would imagine that negotiators don't necessarily have the ability to commit and make creative proposals as easily as those who come from a flatter organization or flatter national culture. So there are some big differences that one would want to adapt for. Even in the United States, I've done some mediation between unions and management in the educational sector. Unions were much more hierarchical, in my view, in the way they would reach decisions on a contract than the school boards. The school boards would be a small group of people with relatively similar social backgrounds and no authoritative figure on the board, while the unions would have a president and they'd have officials from the different, you know, sub-unions, and they would have a big process of voting on a contract. So the processes were different in each, if you will, organizational culture, and they didn't understand each other. So as the mediator, we'd have to explain each other's style and preferences and how they influence the negotiation on the other side. Power, uncertainty, the degree of individual versus collective interests that are important, all of those are examples of some important cultural trends and differences that influence negotiation. So I'm not a fan of the here are the 10 things to do in Afghanistan list for negotiation. I think that will get you into trouble. It's like driving a moped on the DC Beltway. It'll get you into the stream, but you definitely will get run over at some point. I think deeper understanding of the culture you're working with, as well as trying to get your counterparts to be empathetic to your way, are really the key here.
You are listening to The Peace Frequency, a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, activists, and learners from all across the globe to discuss and debate the important work of building peace in our time. The Peace Frequency is brought to you by the United States Institute of Peace Global Campus, preparing individuals worldwide through online learning to prevent and transform violent conflict. Our guest on the show today is Dr. Anthony Wanis St. John. He is the main instructor in the online negotiation course that we are offering this month through the Global Campus. He's also director of the International Peace and Conflict Resolution Program master's program at American University. And we're talking about negotiation, the skills, how he developed it, cultural dynamics of it, etc. And I want to go back to this cultural element. You mentioned you are from a culture that's different from our listener, different from Vanessa, different from myself. Explain to our listeners what is your cultural background, and as you began to develop your skill set as a negotiator, have there been moments where you really had to check some of those deep cultural elements of who you are and where you've come from in order to be more effective?
Okay, that's a big one. You know, I see our cultural identities as intricately linked to our sense of who we are as individuals. And it's hard to separate the two out. And a lot of people just don't think about who they are culturally. People will give you a one-word answer. But I think we're really like an onion. There's just so many layers to peel back. And I certainly discovered that about myself. I immigrated to the United States at a young age from Beirut, Lebanon. And before that, had been born in Cairo, Egypt. So we moved around, as I mentioned earlier. But my parents didn't really tell us our background when we were young. We sort of came with the assumption of Americanizing as quickly as possible. That was my parents' thought. And in the different neighborhoods we lived in and the different political things that were happening in the international arena, I think they really did want to sort of shield us and protect us and not let us quickly be labeled as foreigners, at least the kids. So they just didn't tell us what our background was. And we had to back into that information. My parents spoke French to me and my sister, spoke English to my brothers, but they spoke French and Arabic to each other. And we didn't know what that language was at first. So when we'd ask them, so what are we? When people ask us, where are we from? They said, you could tell them you're French. And I thought that was okay and cool, but you know, I had no idea. And you know, quickly I realized, you know, you have a language that's not French, and we don't eat French food except French fries, which is not French anyway. So I began to ask questions about where our heritage was from, and only later as a young adult did I begin to wonder how much has it influenced who I am today and how I behave and what expectations I have in life. And I'm not sure I have all the answers, but I do know that the answers cannot be boiled down to a single thing, because I am a New Yorker. I am from a military family, and I did grow up in the East Coast of the United States. All those things are true, and they are defining sorts of experiences. At the same time, I came from another part of the world where people think differently than and act differently than here. And some of that has influenced who I am and how I think and how I behave. How much, I'm not sure, because it's hard to separate them all out. I've lived in other countries. I speak other languages. I've adopted other people's ways of looking at the world as well, just trying to try things out. So I've got a number of layers, and I kind of like them all, and I'm not willing to reduce myself to a single word, unless, you know, I need to give somebody an easy answer that they can understand. I am definitely an American, but I am one of those Americans who has a kind of complex heritage that influences the way I look at things.
So when you've been, again, mediating negotiations, or you've been negotiating yourself in different contexts, what's an example where you felt most challenged in that situation in terms of, wow, this is really difficult. I don't know what to say next. I don't know how to read this person. I mean, you tell us the story. I don't want to put words in your mouth. What made this particular negotiation or mediation challenging?
I've got challenges for you. I've got successes for you. And I've got outright failures for you. I'll talk about the challenges first, because they're not entirely successes or failures. They're a mixed bag. When I was a doctoral student, somebody was sitting next to me in our little fellowship office at the Program on Negotiation, which is at Harvard Law School. It's a consortium of MIT, Tufts, and Harvard. She was interested in trying to get a Track 2 project going with young Palestinian and Israeli staff for the big-name negotiators. So not those big-name folks, but their junior-level staff. And I helped her out a little bit. she made a lot of progress and started bringing them together in the United States and elsewhere in Europe, as well as in the region. And over the years, I had increasing involvement with that group of folks, and I saw amazing things happen. I saw interpersonal relationships develop between Palestinians and Israelis who had official capacities and duties that were, you know, put them in opposition to each other. I saw people communicate. I saw people learn from each other. I saw, you know, surprising things given the fact that the official peace process was dead or dying while we were doing those things. What I didn't see was the transfer of those relationships and knowledge and sensitization over to the official process. So that was a frustration. I saw that progress was possible in small groups and at the individual level, but that the politics and the social dimensions of this were a harder thing to challenge. So that's one big challenge. The second is a project that I got involved in through the Institute, through USIP a few years ago. Jackie Wilson and I were asked to go do some sort of a consultation with the Darfuri rebel groups in Chad.
Okay, and Jackie Wilson is a senior program officer here at USIP.
And we, you know, started planning, what are we going to do when we get out there with these military leaders of the Darfur rebel groups? So we had a good sense of what their problems were, and their main issue was unity amongst themselves. The Sudanese government was really good at making ceasefires and peace deals with individual movements and their leaders, the political leaders, but not with all of them together. And they sort of let themselves be played like this against each other. So we concluded that our main challenge would be to get them to unify if we could. So here we are, you two folks from USIP trying to support the U.S. effort to build capacity among the Darfuri rebels. Not by shipping them weapons, but by trying to improve their ability to negotiate with the government in Khartoum. And our role here, my role here anyway, is very modest. But, you know, I was really taken by the importance of this little task that fell to us and its difficulty. The minute we got in there, the minute we started our workshop, I mean, actually a few minutes before it started, we saw a commotion with our guys, and they were actively trying to prevent some people from coming in. So it turned out that folks from the GEM movement were at the door, and folks from all the other movements were like, no, GEM can't come.
The GEM movement is what?
The Justice and Equity Movement, one of the Darfuri rebel groups. So folks from all the other groups were preventing GEM from showing up at a unity consultation. And the irony was not lost on us. And Jackie and I, you know, spent our first efforts with folks trying to persuade them to have some sort of participation, not to just close the door on them entirely. So that was like a bad omen. You're trying to get unity going and they won't even let everybody into the unity talks. So, you know, on the other hand, we thought, all right, let's rescue what we can from this and see what we could do with this group, because they are also terribly fragmented. And for me, the fragmentation of non-state actors is a key component in destabilizing peacemaking efforts. And this just solidified my sense that, you know, more unity is better. And over our time with them, they came to really create some plans for unifying their movements, for unifying their negotiating positions, for understanding that they shared the same constituencies, that civil society was the same for all of them. So they made a lot of progress, and that was gratifying. At the same time, they're coming from a fundamental position of, you know, being easily divided. And I wasn't sure if the little work that we did was going to have a big impact on the bigger picture. It seemed to me that in the following year, they did more things as a unified group of rebels, negotiation-wise. But, you know, that ultimately their own political leadership was going to undermine that. So that's a challenge. That, you know, there's mixed success and frustration in there. But it was a very cool project to be working on. Here's a funny personal success, if this is the right time to talk about it. Maybe 12 years ago, somebody told me about a job that was available that I could bid on as a contractor. And I asked what it was all about. He gave me the contact. It was consulting firm here in DC that had been doing some work for a part of the State Department, one of its bureaus. And it was a big research project that had been undertaken and had been, all the field work had been done. Field work in Italy, field work in Colombia, field work in South Africa. But they had never written up the final research paper and recommendations. Mm-hmm. So my task really was to go and bid on finishing the project. And this was one of those, you know, rock wall moments. I was sort of with the sweaty palms. I got on the phone with the guy. I asked him how much work is there to do. He didn't know. He was, but I could tell he was extremely desperate to get this thing finished. He couldn't finalize his work with the Department of State. And that he was really up the creek. And I felt that leverage for the first time. So he wanted me to estimate how long it would take and what I would charge him. I told him I'd actually have to come and look at all the work that had been done. I told him I'd come at my own expense from where I lived in the New Jersey, New York area down to DC to look at everything he had. So I went in and I just looked at this room full of documents and reports and evidence. And it was a huge mess. And I thought I could really name my own price today and he'll have to say yes. So I came up with the biggest number that I wouldn't be embarrassed to mention to him. And he looked at me and he looked relieved. And then when he was relieved, I was relieved. So, you know, I named a big number and he said yes. And he said, that's really fair. I thought you were going to come in really, really high. You know, I felt a little bit of maybe I should have aimed higher. All right. On the other hand, I felt like, okay, I've got. I know that I could do this work and I'll be very well compensated for it. And he'll get a really fine report out of it. And that was, you know, an important moment of personal success. I dared myself to have a high aspiration and it came out all right. The end result was great for everybody. Should we talk about failures now?
Failure. Let's hear failure.
I've got three failure stories for you. They're all mediations that I was involved in. The first time someone asked me to formally mediate a dispute was a dispute between two librarians in Cape Cod. And the chief librarian and the assistant librarian were having an interpersonal relationship that affected their policies, that affected the way they ran the library. You know, it's just a library. The stakes weren't high, but these two guys did not get along. I was pretty green. I went in and spent a day or two with them and got them to sign an agreement that they promptly undermined. The party that was most belligerent in that case actually felt aggrieved and wanted to take things over, and he succeeded in undermining the whole thing, and it was a bad outcome, I thought, for the library, for those two individuals, and for me it was an important lesson in not naively entering into dispute resolution situations. Fast forward to a couple of years later, I found myself in the middle of a big team mediating a problem among all the healthcare providers in Rochester, New York, through the Chamber of Commerce up there, some business organization. They brought together all the hospitals. There were three companies that owned all the hospitals. They had conflicts with each other, and they had conflicts with the major insurance company that insured most of the population in the city. We spent a month in, you know, one of the coldest cities in America, working really hard with these folks to get them to set aside the personal animosities of their leadership, the business rivalries that they had, to unify the providers against the insurer, and then to unify the insurer with the providers, because the end result was going to be bad. The insurer wanted to outsource to national companies a lot of the services that the hospitals were providing, thinking that they could do that at lower cost, you know, like lab tests and things like that. And there were deep personal hatreds among the executives. These were all, you know, important doctors who had competed with each other for patients, clinics, and other docs. And we succeeded. They created an agreement to create a virtual entity that would bid on all of their services with the insurer. We walked away after a month of that hard work. There was a financial mechanism in place. They were going to apportion tests right and charge correctly. They successfully negotiated a deal as the new unified entity with the insurer. We just, you know, we packed up and declared victory and went home, and it fell apart within I guess the year. Mm-hmm. And two of them joined up against the other and began closing down hospitals. So again, like, you know, the great triumph, the feeling like we got this and people can do this better, and then conflict rears its ugly head again. Mm-hmm. The third is similar. It was a interpersonal mediation among three partners in a business. I worked hard with them for a bunch of months trying to understand why they had started as friends, become wealthy as business partners, and now hated each other. Mm-hmm. And got them to work it back so that they had new ways of working with each other, made a plan for making better relationships with each other, for sharing their thoughts and their decisions with each other. And it started to work. Within a few months, I noticed that their staff were taking the old fight and bringing the fight forward. So the partners were now getting along, but now their staffs were competing and destroying each other. And pretty soon, this sort of conflict poison spread throughout the rest of the organization. And before you know it, two of them threw the third out. And they tried to embroil me to come back and be a witness in the lawsuits. But, you know, mediators, they protect themselves from those kinds of things. All three of them were very sobering lessons in the pervasiveness of conflict and our human tendency to want the easy solution, the one that keeps somebody out, that excludes somebody and tries to get justice at the expense of somebody else. So yeah, failure is instructive. And if you want to do conflict resolution work, you got to get ready for some.
I mean, you mentioned something earlier about how mediators protect themselves from getting embroiled in something like that. But as you shared these stories of mediation, you know, we realize that as a mediator, you are making a conscious choice to, in some way, immerse yourself or be involved in some way in conflict.
In other people's conflicts.
In other people's conflicts. And you do this on a somewhat regular basis.
Right.
What type of impact does that have on you just as a person, where you're constantly, as a mediator, hearing people, groups in conflict with one another, oftentimes getting quite nasty, and the outcomes of whatever that of that negotiation has impacts on the lives of real people. So, for example, in the healthcare example you gave. So what type of impact does that have on you just individually, and how do you cope with that?
The big eye-opener for me was the what I would call the issue of transference. Conflict parties want desperately to make the mediator one of the conflict parties. And they will do everything in their power, consciously, but mostly innocently and unconsciously, to make you have a stake in the conflict. So the mediator with the best of intentions, who gets embroiled and gets partisan, makes themselves part of the problem. So I had good mentors and colleagues who would say, you know, you cannot have that conversation with them. You cannot take their side. You cannot, you know, take this action because it makes you look like you've taken sides here. You have to preserve that neutral space, even if you have your own personal preferences. And you can articulate what your personal preferences and biases are, but you cannot make anyone believe that you will favor them over the other. Because then they no longer will take ownership of their problem, their dispute. They transfer the responsibility of it over to the mediator, which means the blame. So conflict parties have an invisible system of wrecking a mediator's work that's very nefarious and very effective. They get you involved as a conflict party, and then they undermine any efforts you make. And all of this is not really, you know, dastardly. It's just how human conflicts evolve. So good mediators, you know, try to keep you know, attuned to what's happening, the chemistry between the parties, the relationships they have with the disputants. And these things, of course, go in the international domain as well, where perfect neutrality is not possible, where it's very difficult to be a perfectly unbiased neutral. People have their preferences. We're human, but we need to try to not to become part of the problem, is what I'm saying.
We have just a few minutes left in our podcast, and one thing that we would love to hear more about is your work coaching people to be better negotiators. And we don't have time to go into specific individual stories, but could you give us an explanation of what coaching someone to be a better negotiator entails? What does that process look like when you sit down with somebody who's asked you to do this? What does it entail?
I've done it all kinds of ways, and the least effective way is to sort of tell the other person what they have to say and do. That never works in my experience. But if I can get them to role play with me, in fact, to use a technique that was used on me and that I found very effective, to role reverse, where I'll become them, the person I'm coaching, and they can become their opposite party, you know, the adversary or the counterpart. That is incredibly helpful. But when I'm in the pure coach mode and can get them to do a role play with somebody else, I will stand behind them and start a sentence that they have to finish, because typically I can detect things that they need to be saying and thinking that they're not daring themselves to do. But I won't finish it for them. I'll start them by saying, okay, well, here's what I see happening if you continue this course of action, and then leave the ellipsis there and then ask them to finish. Or here's an idea that I have. Would you consider it? And then let them, again, finish, because I know they want to propose something, but they're not finding the words to do it. So it's all about unlocking the language and empowering them to use it and to sort of unleash their imagination about what's possible.
Well, Anthony, thank you so much for being with us on the show today and sharing a little bit more about your background, your experience with our listeners and with the participants in the course. As you know, this is being recorded, so we'll share it with folks who weren't able to join us live. For those of you who are listening online, you've been listening to The Peace Frequency, a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, activists, and learners from across the globe to discuss and debate the important work of building peace in our time. The Peace Frequency is brought to you by the United States Institute of Peace Global Campus, preparing individuals worldwide to prevent and transform violent conflict. And you can learn more about the Global Campus at usipglobalcampus.org. I've been your host, Darren Cambridge. Our producers are Leah Cullins, Vanessa Francis, and Peter Weinberger. Our sound engineer and theme music composer is Blake Mobley, and our graphic designer is Manuel Leon. And I just want to say thank you again, Anthony, for joining us today.
Thank you, Darren. It's been great.
And to everybody else, we look forward to you tuning in next week, Tuesday at 2:30, where we have another great guest.